So if you're anything like me, you do a lot of your online shopping, well, a lot of your shopping at all, on Amazon. So if this is a case for you, and you're looking to buy something anyway, if you go to our website at tensandaces.com, near the top of the page, you will see an Amazon banner ad. If you click there, prior to making a purchase on Amazon, it will open up your Amazon app just like normal, or if you're in a browser, go to the Amazon webpage just like it would normally if you were to type in amazon.com. The only thing that's different is that because you click through our referral link, the Tens and Aces podcast will get a small little commission on whatever you buy. It doesn't cost you anything. It's just a good way to support the show and show your love for TNA and, you know, help cover some of the cost that it costs to make this thing. So remember, if you're going to buy something on Amazon anyway, go to tensandaces.com, click the Amazon banner, and then you're good to go. And you're helping out something you like this podcast. And it's a win-win, win-win, win-win-win. Oh, and while I got you here, thank you all for listening. We really appreciate it. Now, enjoy the show.
One of these losers in Las Vegas who keeps thinking he's going to come up with a way to win at blackjack.
Are you ready for some TNA?
Welcome to TNA, the Tens and Aces podcast. A podcast with true-to-life stories and experiences from advantaged players in the game of blackjack. From pros crushing it and making a living counting cards, to newer players who are just making their way through all the ups and downs of what can be, at times, both an equally frustrating and beautiful game of AP Blackjack. Is this the kind of thing you want to hear? Well, listen up, because we're about to give you some TNA. Here's your host, Mike AP.
And welcome to the show today. As the man just said, I'm your host of this transmission of our experiment in imaginary radio that we like to call TNA, the Tens and Aces podcast. So if this is the kind of thing you want to hear, well, listen up, because we're about to give you some TNA.
I don't know if you ever heard of me before, but I used to be called the Waco Kid.
The Waco Kid. He had the fastest hands in the West.
In the world.
With me today for part two of our interview is the Waco Kid, or Waco Kid. How's it going today, man?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm good. Good. Thanks for coming on again. So where did we leave off?
I think I started talking about how I had played with a partner for a while. I had played by myself for a year and a half, going on 2 years. I kind of realized that I had stretched what I could do on my own to the max. I saw, you know, just the math behind playing with multiple people is really attractive. You can bet more on a shared bank, and it doesn't affect your risk as much. There's just a lot more options available to you in terms of what you can do at the casino as well. So I had started trying to find someone to play with, and eventually I found someone. We can call him Peter. But Peter, he was interested in counting, but he didn't have all the skills perfected, so he kind of wanted to learn. But he did have money he was willing to kick in on a bankroll. So, you know, him and I teamed up, and we would start going on weekend trips together. We would split the bankroll, and he was really good about taking signals at the table and everything. So if he ever ran into situations he wasn't sure about, he would kind of wait for my signal on what to do. You know, this is easy to explain, but really, you know, the first couple times you do something like that, you realize, you know, now there's a lot more to do at the table than just keep the count, vary your bets, and worry about yourself.
Right. You got enough going on. Yeah, right.
Yeah. When you add this other person that's depending on you too, it was like I wanted to do a lot of practicing to make sure that my title of being the anchor was justified, you know? So I was doing a lot of extra practicing around then, just making sure that everything was solid, practice signaling and just, you know, spent time talking and playing with him to kind of get used to each other, you know. And him and I became pretty good friends. We got along great. So we would go play for weekends and usually stay at the same table and just play that way. And that worked out great for several months.
Mm-hmm. So where did you go from there?
Yeah. So eventually I realized that what I was doing with Peter had kind of reached its limit as well, because he couldn't count. You know, you really need multiple counters so that you can be looking at multiple tables at a time.
Absolutely.
And so him and I started branching out, looking for other people that we could play with. And eventually we found another group of people. They were actually students at a local college. And one of them, he said he could count. And I met up with him once and played some hands with him and stuff. I could tell that he knew what he was doing. And he said he had two other friends that could also count. And so Peter and I ended up kind of hiring these guys as back counter for us.
Hmm. It's an interesting angle.
Yeah. So this was kind of just an exploratory move, but we wanted to see, you know, how it would work. The idea being that, well, now we could have either just the three back counters doing call-ins for Peter and I to bet money, or maybe I'm back counting something as well. And then we have like four players counting and doing call-ins for just Peter. So that was kind of our initial plan. And we went over, you know, we went over the plan with these guys multiple times. We felt like we were ready to do like a trial. So we decided we're going to meet up at this casino one night and just play for like 90 minutes and just do some call-ins and see how everything worked. Mm-hmm. And we met up off site. We went over the plan before we even went into the place. And we really just felt like we had it all down. And then we went to the casino. The way the play unfolded ended up being a little haphazard because there's, you know, a lot of things you don't anticipate on a 90-minute play that, you know, people are going to disappear to go to the bathroom for 25 minutes. Or, you know, another thing is in a crowded casino, when you're doing call-ins, you need to be able to see the person that you're calling into a table. So if they're, you know, hanging around one pit and then one of the back counters goes off to a different pit somewhere, they're not physically capable of doing a call-in. So, you know, I noticed a lot of these things unfolding. We still ended up being able to do three or four call-ins. And I think we lost a little bit of money on that session. But to me, it was just like, oh man, we need to practice this a lot. It's not
everybody just there was a rookie at it at that style of play.
Yep. You know, it's the thing about this stuff is it's easy to describe, but hard to execute. I think actually executing it takes real, like, in life practice to really get everything down. So anybody out there is considering doing something like this, I would definitely say practice is important. Take it seriously down to the minute details, because once you get into the casino, it's going to be a lot easier if you're overprepared.
For sure. So yeah, how long did that type of play or that situation last for you before you moved on to something else?
Yeah, not that long. I mean, after that initial play, you know, we told them we wanted to keep working on it before we tried to play again. And two of them immediately said, oh, you know, they didn't want to play anymore. And then the other guy, he was like the most skilled of the three. I think he actually ended up doing some other back counting for us some other times. We would just pay him like a flat hourly rate if he was willing to come along on a trip. Mm-hmm. And so that was good. But really, it was like we tried to expand things and kind of failed. It wasn't the situation we were looking for. So we kept networking, trying to find some people. And eventually we found some other guys that wanted to play on a team. It was kind of a similar situation as Peter and I. This was another two guys where one of them could count and one of them couldn't. And so we had at least, you know, expanded things to where we had two counters and then two other people that knew basic strategy, but could take signals and help get the money down.
Wow. That, not to interrupt you, but I'm going to, that sounds like a lot of dead weight to me. Totally.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure, I don't know. If it was working, it was working, but wow, that sounds like a lot of unnecessary heavy lifting by you and the other guy.
Yeah, it did kind of play out that way. I mean, a lot of these trips were tiring because between the four of us, it's like we always had to operate in pairs. Because only two of us could count. And so the other two players were completely dependent on us to have anything to do. So yeah, you know, we went along with that team for a while, but I think the mistake that we made with that team was with overbetting. We frequently were doing a balanced betting strategy where, you know, you have two people on the same table putting bets out. The way it's supposed to be done is if one person bets a lot, the other person bets far less so that it balances out according to the risk that you want. Mm-hmm. But on that team, we were frequently, I think, putting out too much money between the two. So after a while, we hit a down skid. And the thing about playing on teams is when everyone's winning, you know, it's easy to get hours in. Everyone's happy. When things aren't going so well, it can be a whole different story. You know, people, it's harder to even get hours in or for people to stay motivated and stuff. Eventually that team kind of withered out and didn't really have too much success with that strategy. So
yeah, guys have, especially if guys have 9-to-5s besides the team and that's not their job, it does get hard to keep people motivated when they're not making any money or losing money.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that was that team. And after that, I Peter and I kept playing together, going on trips and everything. And I was also playing on my own bankroll at this time, just kind of building it up.
Peter, at least like counting a running count or something simple like that.
He was working on it. He never got to the point where he felt super confident about it, though. So it was much later on. I did get him kind of playing KO, and he could mm-hmm. do it pretty well. But it took a lot for him to have like confidence in the numbers that he had. You know, he was capable of doing it, but I think sometimes he questioned whether his count was right, even though it was. So mm-hmm. you know, just having that. I think everybody that's learning the game, you start off with that second guessing feeling, and it takes a while to establish confidence in what you're saying.
Yeah, that's what the like BGA trainer app is great for, or other apps out there that can test you out every time you play. Although I do think there is definite value for me anyway, for like just playing through with real cards on a table, on a kitchen table or whatever, versus on the app.
Right. Yeah. I personally like to use the QFIT software. Mm-hmm. I like the Casino Verite. It's got flashcard drills and deck estimation drills, and then just live play drills. And actually, even when you're playing a lot and you know what you're doing, I find that, you know, going through these drills several times a week helps me stay sharp in Absolutely. Between trips and stuff. So even, you know, these tools are useful even once you're up to speed and going, you know, because you got to stay sharp once you're there. So.
I cannot agree more, because sometimes, you know, we're all human and we develop bad habits, and it's best to realize we're making them and then, you know, tighten those up before see a big line on our EV chart, or, you know, our AV and EV aren't matching up and there's this big drop. And then that gets us looking at our game after, you know, tens of thousands of dollars have gone when you've been playing this one mistake, you know, just for example, because that's a lot of times when people notice that something's leaking, then they have a friend test them out, or they look into it. And I think it's best just to stay sharp so that doesn't happen in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, the situation you want to avoid is the one where you're making mistakes and you don't even know it, mm-hmm. because that can be very costly, because you don't even know how frequently you're making those mistakes. It can add up quick.
Yeah, I'd also recommend, I've been doing this for years, get tested out every, you know, 6 months or whatever, by somebody you trust, of course. Don't ask someone that you don't trust to test you out, of course, because what good's that? But like, you wouldn't ask Peter to test you out.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, you want another player who's confident in their abilities to be the one testing you.
So where did you go from there?
Yeah, so from there, I kept playing by myself and with Peter, and eventually we ended up forming another team the following year with some of the people that were on the previous team, as well as some newer ones. So this team had, I think, four or five counters, and then just one player that only knew basic. So this team, you know, we were really excited about. We felt like we had all the right people involved. And we started off, we were doing pretty well, but we had another downswing in this team. It lasted for a while, and we had to resize our betting several times. One of the few times we increased our betting early on when we were winning, we just got crushed when we raised our bet amounts. And so we instantly had to pull them back down. And, you know, this team, the situation culminated with, you know, after the bankroll had been getting hammered from us not running very well, one of the players had the remaining bankroll stolen from his car before he tripped.
Wow. Did he really? Or is that just an excuse people make to make off of money? Believe.
Well, that's what you have to ask yourself when you go through these situations, right? Like, ultimately we ended up, we had a team handbook, you know, and we tried to think ahead for situations like this, what we would do. And I think that the phrase that the handbook said was if a player had money stolen from them, then the rest of the team would come to a unanimous decision about whether they had to pay it.
Fair.
Yeah. And so it was fair, but you know, when we actually got to that situation, I found myself wishing that advice that we had written down beforehand was more specific. So that's one thing I would change about that.
In what way?
Well, just how should that discussion be structured? Who makes, you know, who's leading it? Who's making the final calls on things? Mm-hmm. Because it's the more details you can put down about how something would be resolved, I think the easier it is if the time comes. And team handbooks, by the way, are crucial, because you need this not only to outline what everyone's responsibilities are, and what they should be expected to mm-hmm. be doing, but also just to outline, you know, what are risks to the team legally, or for theft, or getting jumped outside the casino. You know, you need to write down anything that the team is going to have to worry about during its existence.
Did you, I would have had a rule like, if money is stolen from you, that you have to file a police report. Like, you can't say it's lost. You have to go through, because that might keep people from just saying, oh, I'm going to take this 20 grand, 25, whatever his money he said he had stolen. You know, if they have to actually commit a fraud with filing a false police report versus just ripping off his his teammates.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. Yeah. In this case, we ended up coming to the unanimous decision that the player didn't have to repay it. Unfortunately, that was the end of that team. You know, we had once again kind of run into this issue of having a downturn and having trouble getting in a lot of quality hours once that happened. And then it was pronounced by this horrible ending, you know, so that was. It was unfortunate because I had high hopes for that team. But, you know, the amounts I had invested in these teams was only a portion of what I had won. So I was still in good shape after all of it.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, one night in particular on that team that stands out to me is very bad session. I mean, there's bad sessions and then there's very bad sessions, right?
Like, how many standard deviations are you talking?
Well, this is beyond standard deviations, and I'll explain to you why. So okay. we were at this casino doing call-ins, and we got hammered. I think we lost 20 grand doing call-ins that night over a 3 or 4 hour period. And so we wanted to regroup and get dinner and then just go back to the casino that night. And so we all met up off site, and we were going to this restaurant to eat dinner. And, you know, so we're eating dinner and discussing our plans for later that night. And we came up with what we thought was a good plan for this specific casino. And so we were feeling good about getting another session in and putting a dent in our loss from earlier in the night. And so while we were eating dinner, unbeknownst to us, it kind of started to have a freezing rain outside, or like a drizzle. It was in the winter time. And so, you know, we go back to our car after dinner and we're going back to the casino, and we're on some back roads, like with woods on both sides type road. And the speed limit was like 30 miles an hour on this road, whatever.
In but ideal nevertheless, conditions. It was,
yeah, in ideal conditions.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's nighttime, it's winter, there's a light freezing rain. And since we're on back roads, this road, you know, wasn't getting salted. And so we came around this, it's kind of a left-hand bank turn, and it also goes down a hill while you're going around the turn. And so one of the other guys on the team was driving. We went around this turn. Instantly, you know, as we got around this turn, the car started fishtailing, kind of. And we're only going about 25 or 30 miles an hour, so it's not like a high-speed thing, but like the road was slick. And we're going down this hill. And so the car kind of turns sideways. The driver kind of yanks the wheel a little, like to keep it straight so that the tires could help, you know, change the direction of the car still. And he straightened it out for a moment, and then it just went to the side again. So now we're skidding full sideways on this road, and then the tires catch. And so then the car goes straight. And on the left-hand side of the road there, it was like a rock wall kind of, from like, you know, how they cut out the cliff so the road can be there. Well, there was like just a solid wall of rock right there. Mm-hmm. So we ended up hitting this wall and the car going like, you know, 25 miles an hour. So it was a pretty bad accident, but not anything, you know, life threat.
Messed the car up, but not you guys.
Right. And so, you know, we hit this wall and we're saying, hey, is everyone okay? We're like, yeah, yeah. And so, you know, I opened the door to the car and I got out and tried to stand on the road, and I instantly fell on my ass. That's how slippery this road was. It was just covered in like a sheet of ice.
Question, so, was it a rental?
It was not a rental. It was somebody's car on the team.
I hope they had good insurance.
Yeah, it ended up working out for them, actually. Sometimes these situations are an opportunity to upgrade, right?
So, right.
So we're standing on the road, like kind of holding onto the car just so that we can stand up. It was at this time that Peter said something very wise, which was, guys, we should get off the road, because if another car comes around that turn like we did, they're going to do the same thing that we just...
Good point.
Yeah. And so we're like, okay, yeah, great idea. So now we get off the road and we're standing on the edge of the woods trying to get a cell signal to call the police and get a tow. So while we're standing there, we're trying to call to get some assistance. We see like a, you know, like an F-350 truck come around that turn, and it starts to fishtail. And we're like, oh my God, it's going to crash too. But then it straightened out and kept going. And we were like, wow, that was close. And then not 2 minutes later, this little compact car comes around the same turn. And this car was not as lucky. This car started fishtailing and it followed almost the exact same pattern that our car had. And it crashed into the same stone wall about 2 feet before where we had left our car. So it never actually hit our car, but it did crash into the same wall.
So Peter was correct in his assumptions of it's best to get out of that road.
Yeah, he had some foresight that night and potentially saved something bad from happening with that wisdom. Yeah. So we see this car crash and one of us was on the phone with the police at this time trying to get them to come. And the crash, this other crash happened while we were still on the phone with police, which is unbelievable. I think it might have been Peter. He ran up to like see if this person was okay. And it was kind of a younger girl. And she was very shaken up. Her airbags had gone off. She was mm-hmm. just like, you know, freaking out, saying she was going to be late to work. And we were like, you know, where do you work? And she said she worked at the casino that we were planning to go back to. She was a cocktail waitress on her way in for her shift. And so, you know, yeah. So to make a long story short here, eventually the police did come and we got the cars towed and the town sent a truck out to salt this road because the cars were piling up on it.
Right.
So about 3 hours after we had crashed into that stone wall, you know, we weren't really deterred. We were back in the casino playing.
Right on.
So we're playing our game at this point, you know, 3 hours after. And this girl that had crashed her car, she was serving drinks while we were playing. It was kind of a surreal situation later in the night when we all converged back on at the casino.
That's funny. Did she was aware that you guys were who you were when you were?
She didn't know we were APs. No,
I mean, when you're at the casino, she knew that you guys were the guys that they crashed their car also. Just like she did.
Yeah, because we were hanging out by the side of the road talking to her for a while, waiting for the police to. So yeah, she definitely knew who we were.
That's funny you were on the phone, not funny, but ironic you were on the phone when she crashed. You're on the phone with the cops. And it's like, yeah, you might want to send two tow trucks.
Yeah, that really happened. It was like, oh my God, another one just happened. And they're like, wait, what?
Yeah.
So yeah, that was, you know, that's what I mean when I say it's beyond standard deviation. Because when you get hammered by the deck, but then when you get hammered by life at the same time, it really piles up.
Did you guys get some good AV after the crash at the shop?
I don't recall. I think that we broke about even, or maybe won a little bit in that session later that night. But by the time we got back there, you know, I think the crash happened at like midnight, so we didn't get back there playing till about 3 a.m. So we probably just played another 2 or 3 hours at night. So yeah, it wasn't a super long second session that night.
Well, you got a good story out of it.
Yeah, got to keep the story, fortunately. But yeah, so you know, that team ended up, you know, ending once the bankroll had been stolen out of that guy's car. That was unfortunate, but you know, I just kept playing by myself whenever I could. And I still, you know, I wasn't fully satisfied with these team experiences I had had. Even though I trusted people, I felt like, you know, I think in the first case, there was some overbetting happening. And in the second case, we were probably overbetting there too. I mean, it's hard to say. I still have all the data from that second team, and I really just can't see what might have happened there. Mm-hmm. It forces me to question whether I should have trusted everyone on the team. The fact the data, nothing jumps out from that. And, mm-hmm. and I would almost want there to be something jumping out instead of nothing, because it makes me feel like, oh, well, you know, somebody must have been skimming or something.
Right. It's really hard to trust people, even people you think you would trust. Your current team, I've spoken to all the guys except for one who I'm going to be interviewing soon on the team, and I would trust all of you guys, every one of you. I think you're in a pretty fortunate situation there.
Yeah. And that's, you know, after that other team experience I had, I was kind of saying to myself, you know, I'm kind of spinning my wheels with this team stuff. I'm just going to keep playing by myself. And if the right situation comes up, sure, I'll explore it. But I just want to play on my own for a while.
Right.
This team that I'm on now, I think was the right situation, because it was a bunch of guys that I've known for several years. I feel like I know them all pretty well, and we're all confident in each other's abilities. We all had to pass test outs to be on the team and everything. It's just a really good situation. So, you know, were it not for this opportunity coming along, I'd probably would still be playing by myself, because I feel like the bar has been continuing to get raised for teams I'm willing to join as time has gone on. So
I think your current situation is also another benefit, is that you have a team manager that doesn't play at all.
Yeah.
But he can kind of watch, make sure everything's on the up and up, even though, you know, like I said, I would trust every guy on that team completely.
Yeah. Even just, but, you make a good point. I think, you know, if you have a team that's got more than just a couple people, then you almost always need a manager to take care of all the logistics, because there's a lot to do. Mm-hmm. Scheduling and doing the financials and making sure people have money, helping to cash out chips and ferry people around. There's just a lot of logistical support that having a dedicated manager can help to deal with. So that's something that I think is crucial for a team, that any team that has more than just a couple people.
Absolutely. I agree completely with that. So yeah, and of course you got to have a manager you can trust. So he's not skimming off the top, but you know,
right.
Which I'm pretty sure you guys do.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. This team, everyone is rock solid. I feel great about it.
Yeah. I agree.
So yeah, this team, you know, I've only been on it for about 6 months now, I think. So still kind of early in the hours that I've put in for them, but I think I'm up overall so far, and yeah, I'm really looking forward to what the future holds for us.
Yeah.
Now's a good time to take a quick commercial break. We'll be right back.
Hey guys, this is Colin from BlackjackApprenticeship.com, and if you're serious about card counting, I'd encourage you to check out the Blackjack Apprenticeship membership. It has the training tools you'll need to beat the game, like our comprehensive video course and our training suite, so you can learn each skill and virtually test yourself before ever stepping foot in a casino. It also includes the tools you'll need to succeed, like our pro betting software, casino database, results tracking software, and access to a community of like-minded advantage players to network with in our members forum and chat room software. You can find out more at blackjackapprenticeship.com.
What is Budweiser? It's bright, the look of perfection. It's crisp with ideal flavor. It's clean for a great finish. It's pure, made with the finest all-natural ingredients. It's the smooth, flavorful result of beechwood aging. Bright, crisp, clean, pure. This is Budweiser. This is beer.
If you'd like to reach out to the show, you can reach us on our website at tensanesis.com. You can text us or leave us a voicemail at area code 518-289-0478. That's 518-289-0478. And if you still haven't gotten enough TNA, you can email us at tensanesis21@gmail.com. That's tensanesis21@gmail.com.
And now back to the show.
All right, so you found a bunch of questions on Reddit that were, let's just say, beginning questions that we both of us see all the time on there, right? So you sent a list to me, and so we're going to do like a Q&A of these questions, and then you can break down the math and we can discuss these questions, and hopefully they won't get asked on Reddit as much anymore.
Okay, sounds good.
So we're going to try out TNA's new text-to-speech bot. Her name's Lisa. Hey, Lisa.
Hey there, Mike.
So are you down to read some Q&A questions for us today?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, let's get right to it then.
Question number one. What is the worst penetration you've ever seen?
So I think it's hard to talk about bad penetration without talking about online live casino blackjack that's offered. Yes. Those games, you know, they generally are 8 decks and they cut the shoe in half. So they're cutting off 4 decks, which is terrible, terrible penetration.
Unplayable.
Yep. It's also common, you know, if you're playing at a place and they don't back people off, they'll start half shoeing you, where they'll start only giving you 50% penetration on the shoe. So that's common to happen even in real life.
To make you not want to play there, and without having to go through the hassle of getting the security guards and getting the casino manager and whoever to come over and formally ask you to leave. They just want you to leave in your own accord.
Yeah, they just want to make the game not very profitable and kind of annoy you a little so that you leave.
Right. All of us know what's going on.
Yeah, it's a pretty clear signal. Yeah.
Yeah.
But aside from, you know, those special cases of 50% penetration, I think, you know, for a six-deck shoe, the worst dealer I've seen was cutting off 2.5 decks. So just only a little bit better than 50% penetration. And, you know, on eight decks, I've seen a dealer cut off like 3 before, just on the main floor of a casino. So those are probably the worst cases of natural penetration that I've seen.
When I see that, I often make a joke, you know, I'll try to make it sound as ploppy as possible. I'll say, man, you sure like to work extra a lot, don't you? Because especially if it's a hand shuffle game, it's like, if you cut the cards a little deeper, you have to shuffle less and work less. And I've had one or two times where they say, oh, this is just where the boss tells me to cut them. I'm like, okay. But one or two times you're like, oh yeah, that's a good point. And they go a little deeper.
Yeah. So. I've also had mixed success trying to advocate for that myself, but every once in a while, for whatever reason, they'll just like listen better.
If nothing else, just so we shut up.
Yeah. I do find, you know, sometimes you'll see some older dealers, or maybe just somebody who's not very interested in their job, and they'll give better penetration just so they have to shuffle less.
Yeah, or they just know what they can get away with because they've been doing it so while for such a long time.
You know, right.
They know, yeah, they know what they can get away with, how far they can push it, even if, you know, say the house rule is 2 of 6, which is terrible, of course. They'll go like, they know they can get away with 1 in a corner and not getting written up.
Right, yeah. So this is why it's super important when you go to a place, you don't just sit down at the first table you find. You look around a little, you see what's going on, who's cutting off a deck, who's cutting off 3. Keep your eyes open and walk around a bit before you pick a place.
Question number 2. When hitting a hard 12 or 13 against a dealer's 2, basic strategy says to hit, but stand on 13. But why? I feel like I always get screwed on it.
Well, when you have a 12 or 13 against a dealer 2, the thing to realize is the dealer up card of 2, they're not busting super frequently with that card. So that they are going to make a hand more often than not, which means that you're usually going to have to make a hand in order to win in that situation. And so really what it comes down to is running this through the computer says that hitting a 12 tends to return more money than standing on a 12 against a 2. And likewise, staying on a 13 because now there's a few less outs or more outs that can bust you. Becomes right to stand there instead of hit, because now there's like a threshold at play there where hitting 12 is barely worth it, but hitting 13 is a little too much. So really you just have to follow the math on this one and hit your 12 against a 2 and stay on the 13.
Mm-hmm. Just a math-based decision.
Yeah, and I think a superstition a lot of ploppies have about hitting 12 against a 2 is they're always afraid of getting a 10. And you need to remind yourself that, you know, only 4/13 of the deck are 10s.
Which is 30.8%, so almost 70%. If you have a face card with your 2 to make your 12, that's another 10 that's gone already. So,
right.
Yeah, it's just the way the brain works where it remembers unfortunate. And people think, they say all the time, I'm sure you hear this, everybody hears this, I always bust on hard 12. Well, no, you don't. It's just what your brain remembers.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's easy to forget the times where you didn't bust on 12 too, because sometimes you're getting an ace for 13 or a 2 for 14, and these are not exciting hands that you're going to remember. So you sure, you remember shot. The times you catch a 9 and get 21, but you're forgetting all those 14s and 15s where the dealer ended up busting.
But ironically, everybody calls, most people, including ploppies and dealers, they call a dealer 2 a dealer's ace. And they have the same probability of having a 10 with that ace as we do. That just doesn't make logical sense. That I don't, you know, like I always bust on 12s, but then the next hand dealer has a 2 showing. And they, oh, it's a dealer's ace. You know what I mean? And which is another reason why you should, like you said earlier, they're not likely to bust on that with that 2. That's why you should hit that 12, because they have a dealer's ace. You know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, when the dealer has an actual ace, that's when you should be concerned, because the dealer's only busting about 11 or 12% of the time when they have an ace up card, because they get that free hit, you know, where it goes from a soft hand to a hard hand. They get a free 10 before the bust. So that makes it much harder for them to actually.
Yeah, they make 18, 19, 20 vast majority of the time, or even 21, because they don't, like you said, because they don't bust, because that ace can go up and down ladder.
Right. And so even though a 2 is only one, I mean, even though it's only 1 point value above that ace, assuming the dealer doesn't have blackjack, you know, the ace is going to be a 1 or 11. But the 2 doesn't have that luxury of having a soft hand for a free hit. So calling it a dealer's ace is a little bit of a stretch.
I'm sure you've heard that before.
I have, yeah. And I'm always like, what are these?
Question number 3. What are the advantages of counting a 2-deck shoe versus a 4, 6, or 8-deck shoe?
So the number of decks that you're playing, along with how deeply those decks are dealt, is going to determine how frequent each of your true counts are. So if you take 75% penetration as a constant for 2, 4, 6, or 8 decks, then you're going to find that at 2 decks, you're getting the most frequent true count situations to bet into. And then it slowly drops off as you add more decks. And so casinos added shoe games with a lot of decks. I think under the superstition that it made it actually harder to count, even though it didn't. I think high-low was already being used around that time. So Thorpe's count had been abandoned. High-low made it easier to just count any number of decks.
Mm-hmm.
But so it does have a real effect on just the frequency of true counts. And so usually it's better to play games with fewer decks, but those are also often the ones that patrolled the most and watched most closely.
And have higher minimums.
It's kind of a trade-off there. Another point that occurred to me, you know, there's this blanket statement that yes, the fewer number of decks you're playing, the more frequent true count situations you're going to get if penetration's constant.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the value of the game, you need to consider, you know, are they taking big bets on the 6-deck game, whereas the double deck game, that would get you backed off quick. In terms of extracting money from the casino, you need to decide, you know, if you have this great 2-deck game that's watched closely or this potentially good 6-deck game that is hardly watched at all, you could probably extract more money from the 6-deck game, even though it's probably better to theoretically to only play against the double deck game.
Yeah,
so you're gonna have to take a bigger view of it.
If you run sims, you're gonna get a higher EV on the double deck game, but that's just a sim. But in reality, because there are a lot of casinos that cheat their double and single deck games like they're some kind of magical games, and they watch them really close, and for some reason they don't watch their shoe games. So I agree completely with what you're saying, but one consideration that people also got to keep in mind is because the double deck games tend to have higher minimums, they may be less crowded, so you get more rounds per hour, and that's going to affect you also. But if you can't get much money down or much longevity in there, the tolerance of that shop, then even in that case, still in most cases, I think the shoe game would be a better bet. That's where your network comes in play. Who knows current conditions and all that kind of thing, and how much action casinos are taking and all that kind of thing, where all that comes into play.
Yeah. So kind of using that intel from your network and kind of just attacking it from a higher level of like, okay, these are the games that are available. These are the betting limits on those tables. Now, what's my strategy to get the most money out of the casino as possible? That's the way you need to be approaching it. Not just like, oh, they have double deck, so I need to play. Maybe that's the correct answer at one place, but not at another. So you just need to be open to changing the plan based on the information.
So I agree. Sort of related to that question, I get questions all the time, and I see questions all the time, and you probably do as well. How do you feel about BGA's composition-based strategy versus learning a different strategy for double deck in shoe games? I think single deck, you should definitely learn single deck strategy for obvious reasons. Maybe they're not obvious. It's worth learning, in my opinion, if you're going to play a single deck game, but it's not worth learning if you're never going to actually be around a single deck game because they're harder and harder to find. And if they are, they may be 6-5. So it's maybe not even worth your time anyway. But I guess the question I'm asking you, Waco Kid, is do you agree with BGA's composition strategy, and then that the indexes are going to make up any loss of EV?
I'm not familiar with that strategy from BJA. I mean, I know composition dependent strategy in general is just the idea of making certain plays based on the composition of the remaining cards, which is especially pronounced for single deck because the effects of removal are really high.
I think I worded it wrong. It's composite strategy. I worded it wrong.
Oh, composite.
They basically have one basic strategy chart that you memorize for all games. The theory being any gain you're going to get, small gain from learning little differences, you're going to lose just by complicating things and putting more in your brain as you switch between games. So the different deviations for each game set and the expanded deviations will offset any loss of EV from not playing the exact air quote perfect strategy for that specific game type. Does that make sense?
I mean, yeah, that makes sense. I think, you know, I'm sure that the math on that works out. It sounds like you're giving up a little bit by learning one strategy and compensating for it with more index numbers. So I'm sure the math works out, but That's the type of approximation that tends to bother me. Like I wouldn't be happy with that being my strategy. I would always rather just know the basic strategy for the game that I'm playing and have the index numbers and not make compromises.
I think it's recommended by BGA for beginners, so they have less to memorize. And because you can, if you make a few mistakes, you're losing your edge. So I think it's just to simplify things, but I agree with you on that. I was just curious where you were at on that.
Yeah. I see the value in it for new players. I'm just not a fan of making trade-offs when you can have your cake and eat it too. In this case, you can memorize the correct strategy and use all the index numbers.
Exactly. Yeah. Anyway, I was just curious about that.
Question number 4. I am just getting started. If possible, could you explain bet spreads as well as the math behind them?
The idea of a bet spread, you're trying to make a small weighting bet while the pack of cards is neutral or negative. And then the idea is when you finally get favorable situations, this is where you need to be getting EV back that you've been giving away on all weighting bets. So you need to bet substantially more when you have an edge. Now, what you wouldn't want to do is the first hand where you have an edge, you bet your entire bankroll on that hand. There's this concept of risk in determining your bet amounts. You don't want to just go all in immediately, I said last time that I had. That's not a good plan. So your bet amounts at each true count, it's proportion of your bankroll based on how big your edge is and how much money you have. So the whole idea of a bet spread is to kind of spread out your risk so that before you're putting really big bets out, you have a sizable advantage. And it's also, I think, for a little bit of cover, the idea is that if you're moving bets up and down small amounts, then it might look more natural. I feel like that's not necessarily the case these days. I feel like betting spreads that use a ramp do stand out a little bit more than ones that don't.
If they're watching you. If they're not watching you, it'll be less dramatic than going from 10 to 500.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So the whole idea of the bet spread is that you need to raise your bets once you have an advantage, and you want to do so in a way that's proportional to the advantage that you have. And so what you end up doing is raising your bets sequentially until you get to what's called your max bet, which is usually the largest bet that your bankroll can handle making regular.
2 times 300 or whatever it may be based on your bankroll. Yeah, right.
And, you know, the interesting thing with bet spreads, there's a lot of different ways you can design these. So you could have a smooth ramp that goes up really slowly. You could have a jump spread where you're making tiny bet and then a huge bet and nothing in between. You can even, you know, you can play with the values that you're betting at each true count based on how much you know your bankroll can handle betting at that true count. Now you have a range of acceptable bets inside that true count. So maybe, you know that it's okay for you to bet $200 at a certain true count. And you know that the maximum that you could bet on that true count would be $500 for your bank. Well, now maybe one time you get that true count, you bet 300, and a little while later you bet 2, or the next time 4. You can kind of play around with the amounts, and it just becomes a big averaging game. So you can get really creative with bet spreads and play with the math. And great software to do this is CVCX. It's really, really good for playing around with bet spreads for whatever game you're planning on playing.
For sure. And it also will show you just play around with bet spreads, play around with all kinds of things like rounds per hour and deck penetration. And it's dramatic in the information. It's eye-opening, actually. You just play around with just like a quarter of deck and, you know, 20 more rounds per hour, how much your E can just jump dramatically.
Yeah, rounds per hour is super important. It's, I would say, equally as important as penetration, which might be slightly controversial, but I really believe that.
I agree.
It's just super important. And, you know, a lot of times when people are simming their bet spreads, and I'm guilty of this too, don't get me wrong, but it's easy to be a little bit generous with your rounds per hour estimate. So a lot of people like round numbers and they're doing all their sims based on 100 rounds per hour. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I got news for you. If you're playing at a place that has side bets and you're usually playing at full tables and you're simming 100 rounds an hour to see what your hourly is on that game, then you're not even close. You're probably
lucky to get 60.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably 40 to 60 with those side bets getting paid off every,
especially on a weekend night, because even if it's a full table on a Tuesday night at 2 a.m. or something, the people there are professional degenerates. So they know how to play fast. versus a guy on a Friday night just out with his buddy's wife or whatever, and you know, doesn't really know anything, and he's probably drinking too much, and you know, whatever. And what is this side bet? What does it do? Or how do you know, whatever? Or
they have to have the dealer explain how to split the hands every time the opportunity comes.
The dealer tells them they need a finger, they flip them off, you know, stuff like that. Yeah. Yeah. So I agree. Did I interrupt you? Sorry.
I'm having trouble remembering where I was actually.
You were at the CVCX in the value of it, and rants per hour.
Yeah. So you know, if you overestimate your rounds per hour like that, you might play a couple hundred hours and say, hey, you know, I thought I was going to be making $150 an hour. I'm only making 80. What's going on? The game is rigged. Well, no, the game is fine, but you just need to fix your rounds per hour estimate. Maybe your EV is spot on once you do that. So, you know, you need to realize all these things are approximations. There's many sources of error. If you're going to take any number you calculate seriously, you need to take seriously the act of collecting all of the data that you're putting into that. So that's what I would say about that. You know, just treat it as an approximation unless you're taking the data gathering really seriously. You go out and like clock the actual rounds an hour and things like that, then maybe your EV estimate's going to be more reliable.
I tend to go like 10% lower than I intuitively think my rounds per hour should be, just to kind of avoid that a little bit.
Yeah, I tend to be conservative as well, because I'd always rather be like pleasantly surprised, you know. So if I think I'm only supposed to be making $100 an hour or something, and then I make more, I'm super happy with that. So
yeah, it looks better on the charts too. AV's closer to EV. So even though we all like, oh, I got X dollars of EV on this trip coming up to get excited about, but it's just a fake number. So I mean, be as accurate as possible. You know, garbage in, garbage out, right?
Yeah.
Question number 5. How do you pronounce the negative counts in your head?
Yeah, they're just saying how do you deal with negative counts in your head? Do you say -1, -2, or I think I've heard several variations. You know, what I actually do is I add a lone N before the number. So if I'm counting like, you know, 3, 1, N1, N3, N1, 1, you know, that's kind of how it's going on in my head. I just use an N for negative. I've heard some people use M, and some people just say negative when they're counting, which is, you know, what you want to avoid. Because the whole point of this question is, if you're saying -1, -3, -5 while you're right, counting, you kind of lose tempo and it slows you down. So you know, using some abbreviation, I guess, is advisable.
I just think minus sign in my head. I don't say any. I don't say N. I don't say negative. I just think minus sign. And so I'm thinking minus sign in my head.
Oh, interesting.
And I just, like, I think I visualize like red numbers and minus sign when it's negative.
I was just going to say, do you think of a color as well?
I do. That's, but I don't know. Somebody, I can't remember who it was. I heard that, or I think I read that in like a old forum post, like early 2000s. Somebody suggested that. And then I taught myself to do that. And I've been doing that for a long, 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 like that must have been like 2003 or something. So I guess the answer would be whatever works for you. Just, you do want to minimize the amount of, like, you say N, that's fine. Or someone else says D or whatever, you know, whatever works.
Yeah, absolutely. Now I'm going to have to go try your method out. I'm curious how it works at the table to try.
Well, if you're trained to do what you do, it may be a little different. It's ingrained like muscle memory now.
Question number 6. At what negative TC do you wong out at? Do you stay at the table or move to another table? Also, at what TC would you wong in?
That is something somebody could Google or read a book. But what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I think this is often covered in different books you can read. I will say that I think, you know, the general advice is to wong out at a -1 or -2. But I also think it's a bit of a function of what the environment is. So if you're at a place that only has one table or two tables, you're probably going to want to craft a play all strategy for that place before going in, because you're not going to be able to wong out and still appear natural very often. So you can end sessions with wong outs at places like that, but getting time in and continuously wonging when there's only two tables is just too tough. So, you know, if you're at a place that has a lot of different tables, then it's a different story. Now you can keep a tight wong out point, maybe right at -1, and you just pick up and move to the next table.
And wong in at 2?
Yeah, you can wong in at a 1 or 2, or just only play fresh shuffles and leave the table if it gets bad, the white rabbit strat.
Mm-hmm. So just to kind of expand on this question, what's your feeling on the whole debate of play all versus wonging in general.
Well, it's the thing is you can't, the bet spread is a super big part of this, right? Because if you can play all and have a large bet spread, there's no problem. I think where the conversation gets interesting is right. when you have constraints because of your bankroll, where you can't afford to have a big spread on play. That's where, you know, you're going to want to do a lot of back counting and try to minimize the number of negative counts you're playing so that you're just placing plus EV bets. So I think, you know, if you are going to do play all, that needs to be compensated for with a bigger bet spread. And I think when you run sims and play with the numbers, that's what you find is that, you know, doing a play all strategy is significantly worse than wonging out of all those negative counts. And the only way to compensate for that is to just have a really big bet spread so that you're raising your bets.
Yeah. And if you do, like you say, you're red chipping or you're back counting and you go into a table, make sure you don't do what Nubs did and send in a bunch of piss and then stay there because you finally got a chew too. And you're already pissed on.
Yeah. Pick the tables that haven't been peed on for sure.
And then make sure they don't give you ladies. That's key. If people don't know what that I'm talking about, listen to episode 4. That's a great story. It's on there. Anyway.
Well, unfortunately, that's going to be the show for today. Special thanks to Waco Kid for coming on the show again. And thanks to Lisa, the text-to-speech bot. I know that was a little cheesy, but that was kind of intentional. And I thought it was much funner than me reading the question. So anyway, I hope you all enjoyed the show. And I will see you down the fell.
The basic plan we have for the family is the family talk plan. It's called All Talk. You get 400 anytime minutes, which you can use anytime. There's another one called Even More Family, and that is 400 anytime minutes, unlimited nights and weekends.
That sounds great. We'll do that.
There's more options. There's Even More Family Unlimited, which is unlimited minutes and texting plus web.
Okay, so no. One doesn't have texting, the other doesn't have web.
We'll just get one that has everything.
Okay, well then you want the Simply Everything plan.
Okay.
Right. There's also Simply Everything Plus.
Which is what?
Simply Everything Plus texting.
What we want is your most standard, basic family plan with a satellite locator.
This changes everything plan is what you want then. You guys want to add another line for $5?
Yes.
Great, so you guys are all set. That all right. Is the plan, Simply Everything Everything. Shared anytime minutes plus rollover. Great. Okay, so you're all set. You're all signed up. Now there is a nominal fee if you want to keep your current phone number.
Yeah, I thought that was a free service.
After you pay for it, it is free. So
okay,
it's just a one-time fee that you pay annually.
It's not a one-time fee, but
it is one time in that you only pay one time a year.
Great.
All right, great. You guys are ready to pick out your sunglasses.
For all of your TNA needs, head to tensandaces.com.
Are you serious about becoming a Blackjack Advantage player? If that's your plan, then listen to the real pros first. They will tell you to test out and hone your skills before risking your starting bankroll. Check out the Advantage Player Refinement Program, offered exclusively by Archimedes21.com. The A21 APRP will tell you if you're ready. Until then, look into becoming an investor in Archimedes 21 and start earning right away.